Thank you, and thank you to the meeting organizers. It's really great to be here. So again, I'm going to be talking about group adaptation, and I think this topic has really received great introductions so far at this meeting, as have the organisms that I'm going to be talking about. But just to introduce you to them a little bit more, here we have a Volvox spheroid, and so you can see these tiny little somatic cells and these very large germ cells, and also some micrographs of smaller relatives of Volvox. So these are independent cells, Chlamydomonas reinhardii, and this is a colony, a colonial form that's a much simpler species called Gonium pectorale. Okay, so to start at the beginning, if we're thinking about adaptations, of course, we have to think about the source of adaptations, which is natural selection. And when I say natural selection, I just mean that you have heritable trait differences and that these heritable trait differences cause differences in reproduction. So this cause-effect relationship that for shorthand we is the cause of adaptations. And we've already seen some great discussions of the subtleties of the use of adaptation and the way different people have used the word. But my use of it is going to be this kind of standard use that an adaptation is something that has arisen from a historical relationship of natural selection. And you can recognize it as an increase in the prevalence of of trait values that fit the environment, the appearance of design. And what I think is very interesting when you start thinking about these issues in multi-level context is that natural selection, this kind of cause-effect relationship, requires that you have individuals that have life cycles. To have heritable trait differences and differences in expected reproduction, you have to know parent-offspring relationships. Okay, so now there's the issue of causes and correlations, and I want to quickly go through this issue at a single level before then introducing how this issue crops up in two levels. So, for example, if we have differences in deer running speed that cause differences in deer expected reproduction, then that's a very straightforward case of natural selection for running speed, and you expect in that all else equal that you'll get adaptive values of running speed evolving. But it's easy to imagine you could have other traits that have a necessary relationship with the trait of interest, such as running speed. So it could be that larger deer, for example, just run faster and that there's some kind of physical constraints that make this relationship happen. And so you would get a correlation if you just looked at body size and fitness of deer. And so this correlation is not enough to get adaptive evolution in body size. And I think this example is pretty obvious that the correlation between body size and expected deer reproduction would not cause adaptive values of body size. So you wouldn't see a fit between those trait values and the environment. And this is the distinction that Elliot Sober called selection of running speed versus, sorry, selection for running speed versus selection of body size. So just to remind everyone that this issue of causes versus correlations crops up even just at a single level. Now, the issue of group adaptation is also an issue of correlations versus causes, but now you have two levels. So you can have differences in deer running speed that cause differences in deer reproduction, and you expect the evolution of adaptive values of deer running. But then if you imagine that these deers are organized into herds, then you're also going to have differences in average herds running speed. And if you imagine that these herds come into existence and blink out of existence based on the reproduction of individual deer, then you're also going to have this kind of relationship where differences in deer reproduction are related to differences in herd reproduction. And so just like in the single level case, you can get this near correlation between trait values and fitness values. And because there's not a causal relationship, you don't expect adaptive values at that level. And this is basically the issue that many people have raised, but especially clearly by George Williams in 1966, talking about this deer example, that if you just naively look at fast average herd speed, you wouldn't want to call that a group level adaptation. And so he wanted to contrast a herd of fleet deer with a fleet herd of deer. So, again, this question has come up repeatedly, is the issue of quantifying. So if we agree that this herd of fleet deer is not really a group adaptation, then how can we quantify how much adaptation is happening at the group level versus how much adaptation is happening at the individual level? And here, vulvacine algae seem like a really great system to look at this, because you have things like unicellular species that basically have no group adaptation, and then different species that embody what appear to be increasing levels of functional integration at the group level. So to try to get at this question of quantifying how much adaptation is at the group level, we started with a very simple model of what adaptation might look like at the unicellular level. And so I don't really have time to go through the specifics of the model, but the kind of life cycle we're looking at is a palindromic life cycle, where cells grow to a very large size and then undergo some number of cell divisions. And so in the model, this is called N. So in this example, N is 2, and so F, the fecundity, is 2 squared, or 4 cells. And so the way we think about unicellular adaptation here is that as the number of rounds of division per cycle increases, the fecundity at the lower level increases, which increases the fitness, but the generation time needed to reach that size also increases, which has a negative effect on fitness. So there's stabilizing selection on the number of rounds of division per cycle. And so this is kind of our model of what's going on at the cell level, that there's a certain N value and it's causing differences in fitness at the cell level, and you can model what's the optimal N value just at the cell level. Then what we want to do is introduce a group level. And so we introduce a very simple mutation that just holds the daughter cells together for a short period of time as they grow, and then eventually the cells separate and repeat the cycle. And so first, we assume that that all that happens is this group occurs, and we want to now ask, what does the correlation look like at the group level between group N value and group reproduction? And okay, thanks. And so going very quickly here, you just get kind of a mapping up of these cause-effect relationships at the cell level, you know, turn into correlational relationships at the group level. And the bottom line of the relationship between the trait and fitness is the same at either level. It's just the mapping on fitness components that's different. And then the final aspect was to introduce a cause-effect arrow at the group level, which then gets reflected down as a correlational arrow at the cell level. I don't think I have time to explain that. And so So what happens is if you introduce an effect of colony cell number specifically on colony reproduction specifically, that gets reflected down the relational arrow down here. So now you have to consider both levels to calculate the optimal value of n. And the optimal value of n now is no longer just a cell level adaptation or just a colony level adaptation, but it's both, because this cause effect, the hierarchical level of the cause effect relationship is actually occurring at two different hierarchical levels. So I think I'm running low on time, so let me quickly go through this part. So the upshot of this kind of causal view of the level of selection being related to adaptation is that, let's see. So you can take a standard price approach to separate trait change that's due to the numerical dominance of types compared to trait change that's due to within group change. And in this model, we just assumed there was no within group change. So all of these colonies were extremely small. We just assumed they were clonal. So it's not the same kind of social dilemma problem that you've heard about in some other talks. There's no conflict within the groups. So this term is just zero. But then you might want to ask how much of the trait change in a trait like n value is due to its correlation with other traits. And so we also assume that was zero. But the interesting part comes in this partition, where you want to know how much of the trait change in N is due to the group level cause-effect relationship versus the cell level cause-effect relationship. And that partition is telling you how much group level selection is there for N versus how much global individual level selection is there for N. And so the idea I want to leave you with is that there are two very different ways to have something that you might want to call, thank you, cell level selection for N. And so so this distinction really doesn't matter. Interest is just in what N value is optimal. Then the hierarchical levels of the cause effect versus correlation really doesn't matter. But if your question is, at what level of organization is an observed N value adaptive, then it's critical to distinguish between a cause-effect relationship versus a correlation. And it's possible to do that quantitatively. It's not, it's possible to do that quantitatively. And so the final thought that I want to leave you with is just, I think we've heard a lot that this idea that natural selection kind of needs individuals and it needs a life cycle to get going at a level where it wasn't happening before, but it doesn't necessarily need much. Sometimes you can get this kind of group level life cycle started from very simple mutations, and that can create adaptations at the level at which natural selection is happening. But what's interesting, and I think only starting to be explored, is that there is the possible for feedback. So not so much a chicken and egg problem, but an issue of feedback, where the group level might initially have a certain character to its life cycle, which affects what adaptations are possible. And then some of the adaptations that evolve affect the very structure of the life cycle that creates the selective process. So there's a kind of interesting two-way street that I think is still being explored. And with that, I would like to thank people in the Michaud Lab, Patrick and Eric and Zach, as well as other people who I've talked with a lot about this project over in Adelkew and Martin Leslie. And I also just have my email in case anyone has questions after.
We do have time for one or two questions, for those of you who don't like email. Yeah.
So I have a question about the life cycle of the clammy. It's photosynthetic, and so if it's in a deep water natural environment, it doesn't want to go too deep. Is it phototactic? Is it buoyant enough to go to, how does it control its depth?
It's phototactic, and it has two flagella, and it has an eye spot. Okay. For sensing light.
But it's always a set distance below the surface. It doesn't breach the surface of the air water interface, or it's always below water.
I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, I think they probably make it all the way to the interface, but I mean, when we just grow them in test tubes and you kind of see them, they definitely are more dense around
the
interface.
Right. Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll have a cup of coffee with you and talk to you about where clammy actually grows. It's an interesting story. So does your model predict why there's this gonium 16-cell sheet versus 32-cell and above is a spheroid?
No. I think that's an interesting question, but we didn't get into the hydrodynamic details as much, I think, about the sheet versus spherical arrangement. Just speculating what the lines that this model kind of makes me think along is that that the early branching colonials like gonium and basiclamis, that they have a plate formation, partly because controlling cell number to be very small seems like one of the easiest early traits that could change, that was already presumably under regulation in the unicell. And so, whereas kind of production of extracellular matrix and like coordination of cells to form a sphere is a lot more complicated, and it's not as easy to see how pre-existing regulatory mechanisms could lead to that. And so I think that a life cycle at the group level has to be established for a while, so that you have kind of a longer period of selection for more complicated forms of coordination among the cells.
I'm a little bit bothered by your dichotomy between cause and correlation. I don't see, if you don't have a mechanism, how you can identify a cause. You only have correlations always.
Well, I mean, there are statistical methods of basically constructing directed acyclical graphs as a hypothesis of causal relationships, and you can test the pattern of correlations that you would expect from certain predictions compared to others. So, I mean, there are statistical methods for dealing with the patterns of correlations that come from particular causal hypotheses.
So. Fantastic. Thanks very much, Deborah.
Oh.
Okay, how fast can you talk?
So that's the basic idea. We haven't gotten very sophisticated in that, but the idea is that you build a causal model of fitness that you then have to insert into the price equation.
Yeah. Great. Thanks very much, Deborah.